Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. Today, Fred Bartenstein, WISO Bluegrass host and new author of a biography of Dobro pioneer Josh Graves, recently joined Nikki Dakota on Excursions to talk about the life of the legendary innovator. We'll hear a bit of that interview. Also coming up later in the program, a special Politics Ohio with Emily McCord, her guest today, Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and former Governor John Sununu. Up first, we'll hear from Emily McCord in this report. Symphony orchestras have seen a lot of labor disputes recently due to financial troubles, problems in Chicago, Atlanta, Minneapolis, and St. Paul, just to name a few cities. Then there's the Dayton Philharmonic. As Emily reports, they seem to have solved their budget woes by merging with the opera and ballet.
You can't walk into the Mead Theater at the Schuster Center in Dayton and not look up. The domed ceiling, with its rich orange tones, has a smattering of tiny lights that look like stars. It's like being at an outdoor performance at night.
So let's start with Belkis, please.
On stage, the conductor rehearses the orchestra for its opening concert. This season, conductor and artistic director Neil Gittleman is able to offer his musicians something rather unusual nowadays: extra gigs.
In a time when almost every other orchestra in the country is asking its musicians, we have less work for you, we're actually able this season to offer more work to our musicians than we did last year, and that's a really good thing.
Especially because a few years ago, the orchestra's outlook wasn't so rosy. In 2010, the Philharmonic was operating under a budget shortfall of over $100,000. And Gittleman says the Dayton Opera and the Dayton Ballet also faced uncertain futures.
Certainly speaking for the orchestra, we had made, I think, every conceivable cut that wasn't draconian.
So we wondered, could it be done differently? Could, in fact, the three organizations band together? And when he brought that idea to the other artistic directors of the ballet and opera,
I think people thought it sounded a little bit interesting, but probably impossible, which is frankly what I thought. But again, I figured, as long as we're looking at the business model, why not look at the business model?
2 years later, the three organizations are one. The Dayton Performing Arts Alliance, as it's now called, has one board and three artistic directors, which they say will help maintain the distinct identity of each art form. The Dayton Ballet rehearses in a studio overlooking the city. Even though it's cloudy outside, the room is filled with light.
The ballet dancers work during the day.
Karen Russo-Burke is the artistic director of the Dayton Ballet.
We work 6 days a week, where the Philharmonic works in the evening. Some of them have day jobs. And then the opera, they hire out and have auditions in New York and Chicago. They just come in for the 2 weeks prior.
With the orchestra now backing some of the dance performances, the two ensembles had to figure out a way to coordinate their rehearsals. And with all three part of one organization, they didn't want to compete with each other and schedule conflicting concerts. Paul Helfrich, the president of the Dayton Performing Arts Alliance, says other questions remain, like how do you raise money for one organization that presents dance, music, and opera? And how many people will lose their jobs in the merger?
It's like marriage. It's not to be entered into lightly.
Helfrich says the three companies were so lean already, there wasn't much to cut. In fact, less than five people were laid off. And as far as fundraising, Helfrich says donors can continue to support their favorite arts organizations the same way they always have.
We are committed to allowing people to designate their gifts, and those will be tracked, and we will be able to demonstrate that the designated gifts for ballet were used to support ballet performances.
It's all uncharted territory for Dayton. But Jesse Rosen with the League of American Orchestras says many arts organizations across the country are trying to find new ways of doing business.
To me, it looks like a period of great transition. And in some ways, that means it's a little messy. We see an unprecedented amount of experimentation.
It'll take another season for the artistic program at the Dayton Performing Arts Alliance to fully integrate. But right now, for example, Paul Helfrich says you can buy a season pass to see the Phil and get your choice of free tickets to see an opera and a ballet performance.
Anything we can do to make all the arts more accessible and to demonstrate that they're part of a vital community is a good thing to do.
But come December, audiences will really begin to see it. This year, when the Sugar Plum Fairy takes the stage in the Nutcracker, she'll have the orchestra behind her. For NPR News, I'm Emily McCord.
Emily will return at the end of our program with Politics Ohio. Up next, longtime WISO Bluegrass host Fred Bartenstein has written a biography about Dobro pioneer Josh Graves. Recently, he appeared with Nikki Dakota on Excursions to talk about the life of the legendary innovator.
Oh, mama, daddy's got them deep in the blue.
It is Josh Graves and Kenny Baker doing Deep Elm Blues, and it is the first shot in what's going to be a really rich journey through the life and times of one of the true American innovators. And we have our guest today, author of a new book, or editor of a new book, Bluegrass Blues Man. It's Josh Graves, a memoir. It is my pleasure to welcome to the studio, and many, many will know his voice when he speaks. He's Fred Bartenstein. Fred, thanks for being here.
Good morning.
You've been a bluegrass presence on these airwaves. I want to say that you were in Banks of the Ohio, and that you presented that show here for many years. But before that...
Right. Yeah, I've been on WISO since the 80s. I had a program called Country Music College of the Air, and we're calling that class back into session this noon. And then, let's see, I had Bluegrass Countdown for a while where we played the top 10. And then went into Banks of the Ohio, and that was between about 2002 and 2008.
It's altogether fitting and proper, I feel, that you have done this work, that you've done, and that you would be back here today to help us get a little peek behind the curtain. The interesting thing that I didn't fully understand about this book, this book is in the words of Josh Graves. You haven't written a biography, but
I've edited his own work. Josh Graves, who lived between 1927 and 2006, was a great storyteller. And so a lot of people interviewed him, and there were all these interviews lying around from the early 90s, but they had never done a book-length treatment of it. So it's like a museum curator with pieces of a mosaic lying all over the floor.
I
put them together in order and brought it from different sources, corrected some mistakes, untangled it. And I think Josh's voice speaks through this really beautifully. I'm proud that it's the man, Josh Graves, and I just got to help get the word out.
We'll find out a little bit more about how it was that you became drawn to this man. There's it was kind of a sweet personal story to that. But you have even some accountings of very early years for him.
Yeah, let's hear a little bit of Josh's voice from the book. This is the beginning of the book in which he talks about his birth. I was born September 27th, 1927, in Tellico Plains in Tennessee. Nothing there but mountains, and that's what I love. The doctor that brought me into the world was named Dr. Rogers. He could drink more whiskey than you can carry in a truck. I was born at home. There wasn't no such thing as a hospital. All the kids were. A midwife would be there, and then the old doctor would come later and see if everything was all right. I remember when my baby brother was born, in 3 days, my mama was out hanging out her washing. You don't see that now. Tough people, you know. My grandmother Graves was a full-blooded Cherokee. She lived to be 103 years old. Every morning and every night, she'd turn that jug up and have her shot of moonshine. She had an old sweet gum toothbrush and hated me worse than a snake. And I did her. She came from Murphy, North Carolina, across old Hanging Dog Mountain from Tellico Plains, Tennessee. My dad, Troy Graves, worked for Babcock Lumber Company in Tellico. Daddy stood 5'6" and he weighed near 175 pounds, built like a rock. I never sassed him or talked back to him. I wasn't afraid of him, but I knew what he'd do. He moved us in order to work for Alcoa in Maryville. We moved in a wagon, took 3 days. I was only 2 or 3 years old. My mother was part Cherokee. She played an old pump organ. I had 3 brothers and 2 sisters. Coming up in the 30s with 6 kids, man, it wasn't much fun. Mama would send us down to the road every morning to see if any game had been run over and killed during the night. Burlap for curtains, kerosene lamps, and after that, the Depression hit. So this is Josh Graves. He goes on for about 170 pages in this beautiful East Tennessee style.
You have a website, by the way, that people can seek and find. Is this audio collected and available in addition to, like, as a supplement to this book? Can we
That'd be a good idea. We're going to hear a couple of cuts from a CD that came out in 1995 called Josh Graves, King of the Dobro, in which people talk about him and tell some of the story that I'm telling today. But the music, the best of Josh Graves' music, is scattered around in a lot of little places. If you want to hear it, a lot of it, I'm going to be doing an extended version of this class on November the 3rd with Tom Duffy on Midnight Ramble. We're calling that the Geeks Edition.
The Geeks Edition of Bluegrass Blues Man, Josh Graves, a memoir, our beloved presence on these airwaves. Fred Bartenstein has taken the actual words of this American original and put them in a timeline. I really appreciate your analogy of a mosaic, bringing it all back together and bringing a gorgeous focus on this true original. We have a medley of things here that...
Let me set this up, yeah. If I may. So... In a couple of words, Josh Graves' career. He drops out of high school in the first year, 14 years old, and goes on the road as a traveling musician. And he plays in different bands, and he gets in Wilmalee and Stoney Cooper and their band in Wheeling, West Virginia. And then he goes out with Mack Wiseman, and he comes back to Nashville. And an old friend of his, actually the guy that showed him how to play three-fingered style on the dobro, Earl Scruggs, the big innovator on the banjo. Earl Scruggs finds out that Josh Graves is in Nashville and between jobs, and they recruit him to the band. They bring Josh Graves into the Foggy Mountain Boys, which up until that time is just a classic, traditional, great bluegrass band. They bring him in to play string bass, but tell him to bring his old dobro along. And they're trying out an idea of adding a dobro to a bluegrass band. They take him to a coffee shop one morning after he's been with the band for 2 months. Josh figures that they're going to fire him that day.
Oh.
He said they didn't say anything for 10 solid minutes. And then finally, Lester Flatt says, "Would you rather play the bass, Josh, or the dobro?" He says, "That's like taking Brer Rabbit down to the briar patch." "Yes, of course I'd rather play the dobro." "Well, we were hoping you would say that because we're wanting to change our sound to be less like Bill Monroe." What we're going to hear is Josh Graves' dobro tracks from the very first recording session that he ever did in 1955. We've taken everything but his dobro music out. And in these four breaks, Josh Graves creates the style that all dobro players until this day, Jerry Douglas, Rob Ikes, Mike Aldridge, all of them are building on. So this is the main source, 1955, September the 2nd.
So we owe what I'm astonished that dobro was not a part of bluegrass before that meeting, because it seems so integral to what I feel comforted by the sound of bluegrass.
Right. Well, it was actually kind of scandalous in the bluegrass world that they brought this non-Bill Monroe instrument into a bluegrass band. They weren't sure it was going to work at first. But you know, Nikki, we call this book Bluegrass Blues Man, and one of the untold stories, I think, in bluegrass music is this arrival of Josh Graves into Flatt & Scruggs' band at precisely the moment in 1955 that rock and roll is hitting. Now, a modern listener might not remember, but if you're old enough to remember Elvis back in the mid-50s, what rock and roll was back in those days was white men playing black music. And so I don't think it's a coincidence that Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs, canny business people as well as great musicians, decided, let's bring something into our band in 1955, which is when country music and bluegrass are having a very rough time, because the whole industry is going to rock and roll. Let's bring in a white guy who can play bluegrass country style, but who learned from black musicians and who can bring the blues to our sound. And I think that this was one of the things that helped Flatt & Scruggs to be the most successful bluegrass band in history. They never lost a beat during the whole 1950s and 1960s when other bands were finding it very difficult.
So when rock and roll was blooming, a whole new style of bluegrass bloomed simultaneously. So grateful to our guest today, Fred Bartenstein, the author of the new book featuring these dobro, the generator of these dobro sounds. It's called Bluegrass Blues Man, a memoir, edited by Fred Bartenstein, our great longtime presence here on these radio airwaves. Huge congratulations on the new book. You can find out more at fredbartenstein.com, and there's a link to the book. Listen to that. Great big woman and a little bit of butter. Fred Bartenstein, thanks for taking a moment and talking with us and sharing this great, great story and sort of bringing a little bit of extra and sort of much-deserved attention to a true innovator.
It's been really fun, Nikki. I've enjoyed it.
If you want to hear the geek version of this program, you are going to want to mark your calendar for November 3rd. That's a Saturday, of course, from 6, or I should say until 9, until midnight. Midnight Ramble, our guest today, Fred Bartenstein, will be on with our beloved Tom Duffy for a truly insightful look into the life and times of this great man. Again, it's Bluegrass Blues Man, Josh Graves, a memoir edited by Fred Bartenstein. Thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. This week, a special edition of Politics Ohio in the aftermath of the first presidential debate. I talked to two spokespeople for the national Republican and Democratic parties to get their take on the debates and what it'll mean for Ohio and the rest of the country. First, my interview with Congresswoman and Chairwoman of the Democratic National Committee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's in Cleveland this week campaigning with President Obama. Most people are saying that Mitt Romney won Wednesday's debate, and some Ohioans and even some that support the president are saying that he lacked passion. How do you think the president did?
Well, I think the president spoke directly to voters about his vision for an economy that we're growing from the middle class out. While Mitt Romney essentially spent the night lying about his plans and the president's record and doubled down on the same bad ideas that crashed the economy, the style points that some are giving him don't change the fact that his plans don't add up, and he didn't provide any details, and the broad strokes that he did provide essentially lied and when fact-checked about his own plans were proven to be untrue. So, the Mitt Romney that showed up on the debate stage is a completely different Mitt Romney than has been out there on the campaign trail for the last year and a half.
But what about the president's performance? How do you think he did?
Well, I think the president spoke directly to the American people about his vision for an economy that we grow from the middle class out, and was serious and focused about making sure that he continued the conversation that he began with the American people during our convention about his plans for the next 4 years, the progress that we've made since he took office, where we were hemorrhaging 800,000 jobs a month. In Ohio, things were really in pretty bad shape. Thanks to President Obama's decision to rescue the American automobile industry, we've been able to get things turned around, and the 1 in 8 jobs that are tied to the auto industry were saved here in Ohio. So I thought the president was very clear and specific and did a good job laying out where we've been and where we're going over the next 4 years. And Mitt Romney essentially painted a completely untrue picture of what the vague outlines of his policies would be.
And after Mitt Romney's winning of the debate, how confident are you that this wasn't the game changer or reset that the Romney campaign needed to win Ohio?
Yeah, I mean, this was one debate, one event in a very long campaign. We have, and we're proud that the Obama campaign has stood up the largest, most significant, most dynamic presidential campaign in history. We have a very significant grassroots operation. Early voting has begun in Ohio, on October 2nd, and so every day is Election Day here in Ohio from now to till November 6th. And we're focused on making sure that we expand our ground game. And while Mitt Romney's campaign continues to have a handful of billionaires trying to buy him the White House, we are doing the thousands of door knocks and phone calls and outreach and field effort that is going to help carry the president to victory. And I think in Ohio in particular, the reason the president is significantly ahead is because Ohioans recognize that there's a president in the White House in Barack Obama who's been fighting for the middle class successfully and fighting for working families successfully. And in poll after poll, when people are asked, who do they think is more likely to go to bat for the middle class, they choose President Obama time and again. And I think that's why President Obama has been ahead in Ohio and while he'll win Ohio on November 6th.
There are two more debates, of course. How will the president's performance in the first debate affect the strategy moving forward into the next two?
Well, the next debate is on foreign policy, so that's obviously a completely different set of issues. And I think President Obama while doing his day job, remember, I mean, Mitt Romney can spend all the time in the world in preparation, while President Obama is making sure that he can be the commander in chief and continue to do his job as president. But he's going to be prepared and ready. President Obama, particularly on foreign policy issues, has a remarkable record, keeping our nation safe from harm, making sure that we brought Osama bin Laden to justice. So I think the next debate is going to be an opportunity to show not just President Obama's really significant accomplishments in the area of foreign policy, but also how utterly unprepared Mitt Romney is to be commander-in-chief or do anything on the world stage.
That's Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz with the Democratic National Committee. I also spoke to former Republican Governor John Sununu, who joined me on the phone from New Hampshire. And we spent some time talking about taxes. Democrats and some economists have criticized Mitt Romney for not providing details on which deductions he'd eliminate to fulfill his promise to cut taxes without increasing the deficit. We were at a debate party in Dayton earlier in the week with Obama supporters where we met Judith Russell, and I played her comment for him as she was echoing the same statement that many Democrats are saying.
When Mitt Romney mentioned the deductions that he was going to cut, tuition tax credit, student loan interest deductions, if you are getting these credits, you may lose those if you choose one candidate or the other. So for me, I know which economic bracket I am in, therefore I know what choice I'm going to make.
Why is it that we can't get those specific details as to what tax cuts Romney will propose?
Because he's smart enough to know that what he has to do is go and negotiate on a bipartisan basis with Congress as to which ones will be cut, which ones will be means tested, which ones will be included in caps of the amount of money people can deduct. And you don't put a specific list on the table and say, take it or leave it. You go in and negotiate. Woodward made it clear in his book that this president doesn't even understand how to negotiate. And so what we have to make sure is there's enough in the basket, so to speak, to cover the tax cuts, the 20% reduction in rate for the middle class. And there's more than enough. There's about 180% of what has to be in there. And so the Mitt Romney is saying, look, take all the things that are considered loopholes, particularly those for the upper income brackets, put them in the basket. I'm going down to Congress, and I'm saying, give me a set of priorities. Let's negotiate which ones have to be cut, which ones have to be means tested, and which ones have to be included in the cap for deductions. And when you do that, you end up with a negotiated tax reform that provides the cut in rates to the middle class and provides it on a revenue-neutral basis. It just shows what you have is a not-too-smart president arguing for a list that then would be crammed down Congress's throat. That doesn't work. And Mitt Romney saying, put everything in the basket and we'll go negotiate it.
So what do you say when people are like Judith are saying, but the figures don't add up, the math doesn't work out that way?
But she's wrong. She's wrong. There are at least five studies, and I think now the number's up to seven, that have analyzed this approach and said there is more than enough in the basket to be negotiated into the package to allow for the cuts. And with all due respect, she mentioned two or three of her favorites, which are, I think they're number four and five on the Obama talking point list, and that's fine. But there's more than enough there, and Romney knows how to negotiate and deal with Congress. He did it in Massachusetts with an 87% Democratic legislature, and that's the kind of relationship you need to develop to solve serious problems.
Here in Ohio, many polls have been showing a widening lead for the president. First of all, do you think that Mitt Romney needs a game change to win Ohio? And if so, did that happen at the debate?
Well, I don't think game change is the word I would use. I think there's five hard-fought weeks ahead of us, and Mitt Romney needs to do the right thing every day. I think he did the great thing in the debate in giving about 20 to 30 million of the 58 million viewers that had not seen him before. He gave the 28 to 30 million a chance to see him directly without the filter of the hate ads that Obama's been running in places like Ohio, or without it being just a snippet clip that some piece of the media may run at night. This was Mitt Romney for 90 minutes. People saw that he knows the issues. He knows them in depth. He knows the facts. He knows how to tie the facts together properly. He knows the problems the country's having with jobs, and certainly Ohio is one of the hard-hit areas of the Midwest that has jobs concerns. And I think Mitt Romney showed he knows how to fix the problem.
And we know that Mitt Romney was well prepared for that first debate. The next one's a town hall style. And it could be argued that that might be a setting that the president's more comfortable than this first debate. So how does Romney prepare for this one? What's the strategy?
Well, it might have been argued before the debate two evenings ago that the president might have been more comfortable in that environment, too. But he turned out he wasn't. I've seen Mitt Romney do town hall meetings in New Hampshire through the whole primary process. I think Mitt's going to be fine. Each one is a slightly different challenge. He's going to work hard and prepare. And I suspect after the debacle of the first debate, you might even see a president that decides to work hard and prepare.
I've been speaking with John Sununu, former Republican governor of New Hampshire. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much, Emily. Appreciate it.
That's it for this week's edition of Why So Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. We are a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next, the Book Nook, but here's a look at tonight's Sunday Documentary Hour with Sarah Buckingham.
Tonight on the Sunday Documentary Hour, another installment of Burn, an energy journal. Earlier in this series, we heard about nuclear power on the anniversary of Fukushima and about the hunt for oil. Now, Alex Chadwick examines how, in this election season, a single person, place, or policy can, with a boost from science, affect the nation's search for greater energy independence. President Barack Obama and his opponent Mitt Romney share one broad policy goal, greater energy independence for the United States, but they differ on how to achieve it. In this edition of Burn, your host Alex Chadwick goes to the sometimes swing state of Pennsylvania to examine fracking, the politically volatile exploration technology that has made natural gas the single most important element remaking our energy economy. We also go to Michigan, where voters will say yay or nay to wind power, praised by many Democrats as a renewable energy source well worth supporting, criticized by many Republicans as not viable in the free marketplace. That's a brand new episode of Burn, an Energy Journal, tonight at 6 p.m. on the Sunday Documentary Hour. And don't miss Amy Poehler on tonight's episode of WTF with Mark Maron. That's coming up at 11 p.m.
Hi, I'm Nina Ellis, General Manager of WYSO. Our fall fun drive begins Wednesday, and we can't wait to take your phone calls. And Tuesday is Cyber Day. Go online and pledge and help us get a head start on the drive. Do it by midnight and be entered into our drawing to win a getaway in Yellow Springs. You don't have to pledge to be entered, but we know you want to help keep WYSO strong. So go to WYSO.org on Tuesday, Cyber Day. Thanks.